Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed and were inspired by part one. Now it's time to really get down to business. In module two, I'm going to try to save you from the number one mistake first-time writers make, writing the wrong book. Writing the wrong book is like building a fire. Most first-time authors, they pile the wood, toss in a match, hope the spark of creativity ignites the flame of genius. But the only problem is that writers who take that approach usually see their dreams go up in smoke. Writing the right book is like building a house. Smart authors know that long before they ever start putting words on the page, they need to think. They need to plan. They need to organize. And that's what we're going to do right now. We're going to start drafting the blueprints for what will eventually become your masterpiece. The way that I started in the book business was both a blessing and a curse. Never really had a good teacher or a mentor to show me the ropes, and never worked as the apprentice to a master. And as a result, I kind of had to find my own way in the dark. And in my first couple of years as an agent, I took on all sorts of book projects that I was never able to sell to publishers. I would find authors who had high profiles, the top experts in their subjects. I'd sign them up. They'd have all these exciting plans for how to promote their books after they hit the shelves, and we would prepackage the book proposals with endorsements from celebrities, best-selling authors, respected academics. In my mind, and probably in the authors' minds as well, those should have been amazing income-producing properties for their creators. But when I would try to find publishers for those books, I would often fail. And for an agent, failing to sell a book is the worst possible thing that can ever happen. So there's something you need to know about literary agents. Because most agents work for authors on a straight commission basis. The one thing that terrifies us the most is taking on books that we wind up not being able to sell. In statistics, statisticians divide errors into two categories, type 1 and type 2. In academic jargon, a type 1 error happens when you reject the null hypothesis when it's actually true. And in a type 2 error, you reject an alternate hypothesis when that hypothesis is actually true. That's just kind of a fancy way of saying that type 1 errors are false negatives. You think something's wrong when it's actually right. And type 2 errors are false positives. You think something's right when it's actually wrong. And the best literary agent in the world would much, much, much rather make type 1 errors than type 2 errors. That is, we would much rather say no to a book that goes on to sell successfully than yes to a book that doesn't sell at all. Why? It all boils down to time. When an agent takes on a book or a client, between the time that the agent signs the book and the time that he knows it's going to sell or not sell, the agent will probably put in, let's say, anywhere between 20 and 60 hours of work. The only way an agent on straight commission is ever going to get paid is if the book actually sells. And not only that, but the book is going to have to sell for enough money to compensate the agent for those dozens of hours of work. If a book makes, let's say, $10,000 for its author, the agent will usually make about $1,500. But if you put in 50 hours on that project, it means you're only making an hourly rate of $30 an hour. And worse, the project doesn't sell at all. You've still put in 50 hours, but your hourly rate is $0 an hour. And an agent whose hourly rate of pay is $0 an hour probably isn't going to be an agent for very long. So, as a result, agents try to represent books that are as close to possible as sure things. So think about it. An agent, any agent, can miss representing 50, 100, 150 New York Times bestsellers in a given year and still make hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars from the other books they sell. But an agent who takes on 50 books he or she can't sell is going to starve. If you've tried to get an agent in the past and said, man, why won't someone at least just take a chance on me in this book? There's your answer. Given the choice between a book that has a 50% chance of making $100,000 and a book that has a 100% chance of making only $50,000, the vast majority of agents will take the sure thing every single time. Publishers feel the same way, but even more so. Because when a publishing house makes a commitment to a book, it comes along with not just a commitment of time, and not just one person's time either, the time of a whole team. Editors, designers, salespeople, publicists, marketing people, not to mention the overhead that they have to maintain to run their operation. It also comes along with a big financial commitment. First, there's the advance, of course, and at the level I want you all to eventually play on, that could be hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars. But even if the publishing house weren't giving the author an advance, they still have to bear all of the other expenses that come along with publishing a physical book. They have to pay the printers to print the thing, and for a hardcover, that's probably about, to be conservative, let's say $3 a book to start off. And even for a modest book, the initial print run is going to be around 10,000 copies or so. That's $30,000 right there off the top. And then they have to pay truckers to send them to the warehouse or ebook conversion people to make them into electronic book files. They might spend a little bit on publicity and on marketing, so on, so on. And then there's money they're going to pay to the retailers. When you walk into a bookstore, if you're the kind of person who still walks into bookstores, what's the first thing you do? You look at what's on those front tables, right? Well, how do you think those books got onto the front tables? You think the store puts them there because they're the prettiest books? Because they're the right size? Is it a random lottery? No, of course not. That's valuable real estate. And the publishers actually pay the retailers for that A-list placement. Those placement fees, which are called cooperative advertising, can range from about $1 a book per month at a traditional store to as much as $5 a book or more at high traffic locations like an airport bookstore. And even if you're purely digital and you only want to sell at Amazon.com or BN.com, there's A-list real estate in those places as well. Publishers pay a non-trivial amount of money to get the best online placement for books too. So add it all up, by the end of the day, you're looking at a minimum investment of $50,000 for a publishing house to even begin thinking about publishing a small nonfiction book. And that's why publishers aren't just scared, they're terrified of taking on a book that's not going to work. They don't just want the sure thing, they need the sure thing. And that's also why everything in the Write Book Right Now program is geared towards making agents and publishers look at you as one of those sure things. So, back to the story. In my first couple of years as an agent, my rate of success in placing nonfiction books was okay. It was maybe about 50%. But that wasn't anywhere near good enough for me. I was spending far, far too much time on books that weren't selling. If it had been 0%, it would have been easy to know what to fix. Everything, right? I would have just pulled a George Costanza and done everything opposite of the way that I thought it should be done. And that wasn't the problem. The problem was that I was having some success, I just didn't know why or how to replicate it. If I had a mentor, someone like the present-day me, I probably could have just asked what I was doing wrong, but I didn't. So I had to figure it out myself, and eventually, I did. Now, I sell close to 100% of the books I take on. So how did I get from there to here, and why is it important for you? Well, the first thing I did was to look at the books that I was able to sell early on in my career, to see what they had in common. Now, I've got the benefit of 10 years of sales, so I can share an even larger sample size. So let's try it this way. I'm going to talk about 10 books I sold and 5 that didn't, and tell you a couple of things about those books and their authors. And as you're listening, try to see if you can figure out what, if anything, these books may have in common. Compare these in your head to the book that you think you want to write to see if you can come up with similarities or differences. Simple enough, right? Might be easiest to take a couple of notes in this section, so we'll pause for a little bit while you get your paper. Okay. Here we go. Here are some successful books. And in case you're wondering how successful, these books together have garnered advances and earned royalties in the millions of dollars. One of the first nonfiction books I ever sold was called Into the Kill Zone, A Cop's Eye View of Deadly Force. This book is an oral history of stories told by police officers of times that they shot people or narrowly avoided shooting people in the line of duty. The author's a former police officer who himself shot and killed a criminal, and it shook him so much that he eventually wound up leaving the police force. He later became a professor at a small Midwestern university. Malcolm Gladwell talked about this professor's research in his book Blink and called it, quote, fascinating and extraordinary. That's book number one, Into the Kill Zone. The second is called Going Corporate, Moving Up Without Screwing Up. The authors were a law school student and the executive assistant to the editor-in-chief of a large national celebrity magazine. No quotes from best-selling authors. It's a corporate survival guide for 20-somethings. Practical advice on everything from email etiquette to, I kid you not, how to deal with someone who consistently stinks up the office bathroom. And now at this point, if you're wondering whether there's a market for your book, you may feel a little bit better, and that's a good thing. So number two, Going Corporate. Number three, Common Sense Economics, Straight Thinking About Wealth and Prosperity. It's a primer on free market economics written by professors at 3 large public universities. It was originally self-published and sold nearly 100,000 copies before we did the deal. Not bad. When I sent it out to publishers, it was prepackaged with quotes from 2 Nobel Prize-winning economists. Common Sense Economics. The fourth is A Wall of White, The True Story of Heroism and Survival in the Face of a Deadly Avalanche. This book was written by a Sports Illustrated journalist who actually also happened to be a former CIA spy. It's the story of the 1982 Lake Tahoe avalanche, the deadliest winter disaster in North American history, and the intrepid band of ski patrollers who worked day and night to rescue one woman who was trapped under the snow and the ice for 5 days. She lived, by the way. It was also the first successful winter dog rescue in North America. So that one's called A Wall of White. Next, number 5, is Flawless, Inside the Largest Diamond Heist in History. It's a real-life Ocean's 11-style narrative about a dapper band of Ferrari-driving, Armani suit-wearing band of super thieves who stole over $100 million in diamonds from a supposedly impenetrable vault in Belgium over Valentine's Day weekend in 2003. The authors were an attorney who was a diamond aficionado and a journalist who had previously written a book on conflict diamonds. That one's called Flawless. The sixth book is called Whip Smart. It's a memoir about secret lives. When we sold the book, the author was a graduate student getting a master's in fine arts at Sarah Lawrence College. It's her personal account of the time she spent as an undergraduate student when she was an active heroin and cocaine addict and was working as a professional dominatrix. Now, as an aside, agents often become known for doing certain kinds of books. Some agents specialize in romance, some specialize in computer reference books, some do business narratives, some do diet and health, some do science fiction and fantasy. You get the picture. And usually, when an agent is successful with a certain type of book, that agent will get all kinds of other submissions from similar authors. As soon as I sold this book, I started getting inquiries from, well, let's just say lots of adult service providers. And as amazing and lovely and well-written as Whip Smart is, I'm pretty sure it's going to be the only book in this space I ever represent in my career. So let's see. Okay. What else do you need to know about this title? Right. The author was also the curator of a literary reading series in New York City. So Whip Smart. By the way, if any of these books sounds interesting to you, they're all in print. They're all available wherever books are sold. And, of course, my authors would be grateful if you decided to buy a copy or 12. And actually, if you do decide to buy one of those books and read it, I'd love to know what you think of it. You can always email me and my team at writebookrightnow@foliolit.com and know that we love feedback both about books we've sold and the Write Book Right Now program. So please do read some of these books and email us. Back to the program. Book 7, Crash of the Titans. It's a narrative account of the 2008 financial collapse told through the lens of the merger between Bank of America and Merrill Lynch. The author at the time was the Wall Street Reporter for the Financial Times. The FT has combined print and online readership of about 2.1 million people daily. The book originally started as a story that the author broke in the paper about a high-level scandal. So that one's number 7, Crash of the Titans, Financial Journalism. Book number 8. Man 2.0, Engineering the Alpha. It's a comprehensive guide to health for men using a framework of natural hormone optimization. It's a diet book and a workout book geared towards making sure men have the tools they need to reach their true potential. The authors are John Romaniello and Adam Bornstein. Romaniello, who most people call Roman, is one of the top internet fitness experts. He's got a mailing list of tens of thousands of people. He's a personal trainer as well, and had trained a lot of A-list celebrities and professional athletes. He was 30 years old when we sold the book. Adam Bornstein is a journalist who, at the time we did the deal, was the editorial director of LiveStrong.com, which is one of the biggest health and fitness sites on the internet. It had tens of millions of daily readers. As I was writing the program, by the way, and trying to figure out which books to select to illustrate the point that I'm making, the book was in the top 10 on BNN.com, right below another guy you might have heard of named Dan Brown. So that one has been remarkably successful. Hit the New York Times bestseller list and is a fantastic book. Book 9 easily takes the cake for the most interesting title of any book I've ever worked on. It's called Andy Roddick Beat Me with a Frying Pan, and it's got the longest subtitle of any book I've ever worked on. The subtitle is Taking the Field with Pro Athletes and Olympic Legends to Answer Sports Fans' Burning Questions. Now, that's kind of a mouthful. We'll be talking a little more about titles and subtitles later in the program, and we'll come back to this one, but this book, written by another former ESPN journalist, is sort of an update to Paper Lion, the old George Plimpton classic. The author decided to perform experiments to figure out the answers to absolutely absurd but really fascinating sports-related questions like, would a morbidly obese goalie change the sport of hockey forever? Would sumo wrestlers perform well in the NFL? And the question that inspired the title, could a regular guy playing with a real tennis racket consistently beat a professional tennis player armed only with a cooking implement? And that's all I'm going to say about that one. So Andy Roddick beat me with a frying pan. The last book is The Charge, Activating the 10 Human Drives That Make You Feel Alive. One of the world's foremost experts on personal development, number one New York Times bestselling author Brendan Burchard presents a framework for identifying what's missing in readers' lives and gives them solutions for how to live a fulfilling, satisfying, truly charged life. When I sent that one out, it was prepackaged with quotes from David Bach, Jack Canfield, Daniel Amen, Paulo Coelho, and a bunch of other best-selling authors and celebrities. Brennan's previous book was essentially self-published, but it did hit number one on the New York Times bestseller list, even though it was self-published. So, The Charge. And there you have it. I'll recap these 10. Number one, Into the Kill Zone, the book about cops shooting people. Two, Going Corporate, the Corporate Survival Guide. Three, Common Sense Economics, the Economics Primer. Four, A Wall of White, the Story of the Avalanche Rescue. Five, Flawless, the Story of the Diamond Heist. Six, Whip Smart, the Dominatrix Memoir. Seven, Crash of the Titans, the account of the financial collapse. 8, Man 2.0, the health fitness diet book. 9, Andy Roddick beat me with a frying pan, the book on sports questions. 10, The Charge, the self-help and personal development book. Can you see what all those things have in common? Don't worry, I can't either. Not yet, at least. There's still something missing. We've talked a little bit about what works, but we don't know yet what doesn't work. So let's talk about some of the books that I took on that didn't find a home, books that were ultimately not successful. I'm not going to name any names in this section for pretty obvious reasons, but I'll tell you enough about each book to give you the information you'll eventually need to see the differences between these books and the ones that worked. The first one was a very successful obstetrician's memoir about his time delivering babies and the effect it had on his own family. It was really, really well written and had a big emotional impact, so much so that it had me crying at points. And at the center of the book is the story of one baby that the doctor wasn't able to save, who eventually wound up dying, and how that affected all the other subsequent cases in his career. So that's one that didn't work. The second book that didn't work was a business book. It talked about the deceptive practices of stockbrokers and other financial professionals and, you know, in fact, might have been a little bit ahead of its time with respect to what we eventually wound up seeing happen in 2008 and later. But this book really focused on how the advice that financial professionals give is not only often wrong, but is counterproductive and self-serving. And the author was a columnist for one of the top 10 largest newspapers in the United States, so not a bad platform from which to promote. But that one didn't work either. Book 3. It was a journalist's history of the underground hip-hop music movement in the United States. Now, the guy who was writing it was an award-winning reporter who had written for some of the top music publications in the country and had access to some of the most important underground rap stars in New York, LA, Atlanta, Chicago, and a host of other places around the country, as well as a bunch of A-list musicians who gave him blurbs. Book 4. This one's interesting. It was a book by an academic, a sociologist, PhD, that examined the phenomenon of women marrying later in life, specifically women who were unmarried or who got married for the first time after the age of 30. It was both an examination and an explanation of the increasing numbers of women who get married later in life. And it was also a book meant to inspire those who still desired a lifelong commitment, although, you know, they might have imagined it might come in an earlier part of their lives. Book 5. Last one. This one was a book on the dangers and potential complications of LASIK laser eye surgery. The author was once again an experienced journalist who had written about the topic in several A-list magazines and had appeared on a variety of TV shows, like a lot of TV shows. The book was meant to lay out in objective fashion the benefits and risks of the surgery to allow readers to make a better informed choice about whether to go through with it or not. So once again, here's a rundown of the 5 that, just for whatever reason, and we'll talk about that in a second, didn't make it. Number 1 was the obstetrician's memoir. Number 2, the book about how your stockbroker is ruining your life. Number 3, the book about underground hip-hop. Number 4 was the book about the phenomenon of marriage over 30. Number 5 was the book on the dangers of laser eye surgery. So there you've got 10 winners, 5 losers. What's the difference? What's the one thing that all the winners have in common, and what do they have that the losers don't? I'll let you think about it for a few seconds. Okay, that's long enough. So if you can spot it, you should drop what you're doing right now, move to New York City, and become a literary agent, because it took me more than 8 years to figure out the secret of what the one thing is that makes nonfiction books work. And the reason for that is pretty simple. There's not just one reason nonfiction books work. There are 7 reasons people buy trade nonfiction books. Trade book, by the way, is the industry term for a general book that's differentiated from an academic book or a reference book. So stop what you're doing right now, because what I'm about to tell you is one of the most valuable things in the entire program. If you are writing a book that doesn't fit into one of the following categories, you are going to fail. You might wind up getting a publisher for your book, But when it hits the shelves, people aren't going to buy it. And as I tell all my authors, you don't get rich selling books to publishers, you get rich selling books to people. Not to mention that a lot of authors lose sight of the fact that you don't change the world by virtue of getting a book advance. A lot of agents do, too. But you can only change the world and change people's lives when they actually buy your book and, you know, read it. So, what are the 7 reasons that people buy nonfiction books? This may be part of the program where you want to pause and take some notes. Cool. You ready? And remember what we talked about at the beginning of this module. The number one mistake first-time authors make is writing the wrong book. To work as a commercially successful idea, your book must satisfy one of the reasons people like to buy nonfiction books. And here they are. Number one, to solve a problem they know they have. I'll repeat that. To solve a problem they know they have. Solve a problem they know they have. And the second part of that statement is more important than the first. If you're trying to help someone solve a problem they don't know they have, you're not an author, you're an evangelist. And from a business perspective, it's a much, much better proposition to be the guy selling the Bibles than the guy going out and preaching the word. Now, some of you out there are going to want to argue with me and tell me how important it is to tell people that they have a problem, and I will not argue with you. A lot of people have a lot of problems, and they absolutely, positively need to know it. That said, they're not going to pay $25 for a book to find that out. If your goal is to tell people that they have a problem, you're much better off working in another medium. You're better off creating an audio course, doing coaching, doing consulting, shooting video, doing seminars, or all sorts of other things. But publishing a trade nonfiction book is not the right way to go. Now, as I was going through the list of books that worked and the list of books that didn't work, one of the things you might have said to yourself was, well, you know, the books that worked were mostly written by experts. And that's true, but just because you're an expert, it doesn't mean that you can write a book on the subject in which you're an expert, because a lot of the books that didn't work were written by experts too. And as a matter of fact, I get approached all the time by people who are experts who have amazing followings. They're the top people in their fields. They're doing critical, important work, changing lives, saving lives every day. And it's awesome. But they inevitably want to do a book that fits in with their fairly narrow area of expertise. And I have to tell them, look, I'm sorry, a book is just the wrong format for what you do. One of my dear friends is one of the world's top book publicists, and he's worked with mega best-selling authors like Mitch Albom, Mark Victor Hansen, Jack Canfield, Nicholas Sparks. And anyway, he introduced me to a woman a few years ago who was in huge media demand. Every show wanted her to be on. Big corporations were calling her, trying to get her to endorse their products. She was making $1 zillion in the consulting business, and she naturally felt it was time to write a book. The problem was that the area in which she was an expert was home safety. She could walk into your living room and within 10 seconds point out the 3 things that were most likely to kill you. Now, is that kind of information valuable? You better believe it. But is someone going to pay $25 for a book that will teach them that lesson? No, it's very, very unlikely. That's because she was trying to tell people about the problems they had, not show them how to fix a problem they knew they had. And that, by the way, is why the book about complications from LASIK laser eye surgery didn't work. I'm going to go even one step further. A book about the benefits of laser eye surgery probably wouldn't have worked either. Well, why is that? Because the act of buying the book doesn't allow consumers to feel like they're solving the problem. They still need to go to a doctor and then have surgery. That's what solves their problem. Think about that. The act of buying that book wouldn't allow consumers to feel like they're solving their problem. They still have to take another step. They're not fully empowered. Remember that phrase, fully empowered by the purchase of the book. So what are the kinds of books that do work in this space? Well, let's take diet books. People are overweight. They know it, and they buy a book that fully empowers them to solve that problem. Books that deal with addiction. books that teach you how to repair things that are broken in your house. Relationship books often fall into this category. You get the picture. Two of the books we talked about above that were big winners, The Charge and Engineering the Alpha, fit into this category too. The Charge, because people who are depressed or unfulfilled know it. To be more precise, they don't necessarily know that they're depressed per se, but they know that they feel bad and want to feel better. Buying The Charge fully empowers them to turn around their lives and feel happy and satisfied again. Engineering the Alpha is a diet and workout program that helps men burn more fat, gain more muscle, and feel happier about themselves by naturally, without any supplementation, manipulating their hormones. No shots, no pills, a turnkey solution that fully empowers the reader, and that's one of the reasons why the book has done so well. So I'll say that one more time. Reason number one that people buy nonfiction books is to solve a problem they know they have. Number two, people buy nonfiction books to take advantage of an opportunity they believe exists. To take advantage of an opportunity they believe exists. One more time. To take advantage of an opportunity they believe exists. The opportunity doesn't even necessarily have to exist, but people have to believe it does. So a book called Build Your Own Rocket Ship from Spare Parts in Your Garage isn't going to work, at least if it's not a serious book. Nobody in their wildest dreams thinks that they can get to the moon with a lawnmower engine and a gigantic ball full of rubber bands or something. On the other hand, a book like David Bach's brilliantly titled Start Late, Finish Rich directly speaks to an opportunity that people believe they have, whether they actually do or not. Can an 85-year-old pick that book up, implement the evidence, and quote-unquote finish rich? I don't know, but my guess is probably not. But if the 85-year-old believes it's possible, he or she is a likely candidate to invest $25. Virtually any book that's in the how-to space, which is the space that publishing professionals refer to as prescriptive, probably fits into either the previous category or this one. One of the most successful writing books of all time is literary agent Donald Moss's book, Writing the Breakout Novel. It's all about how you can craft a piece of fiction that will take your career to the next level as a novelist. People do truly believe that they can write a breakout novel and that this book will show them how. Now, Don has written, I think, 3 or 4 other books, and that one seems to have outsold all the others put together. What's another example of this? Harvey Penick's Little Red Book has sold hundreds of thousands of copies. Why? Well, people knew that Penick was an A-list coach of PGA Tour professionals, and they believed that his advice could help them improve their golf game. A lot of my friends have bought that book. And nothing, I tell you, believe me, nothing short of finding a lamp in the sand dunes in the desert could help their golf games. But since they believed it was possible, they were willing to spend the money. Back to The Charge. The bulk of the marketing for The Charge, by the way, focused on the promise of the charged life rather than the fix of a crappy life. Here's a paragraph from the proposal. Quote, "In the best moments of your life, there was a spark. You felt it, and you never completely forgot it. So the question is, what drove that spark? What was it that made you feel so alive, and how do you bring that feeling into your everyday life? It's time to do the hard mental homework and deep introspection to figure this out. Luckily, you have a roadmap now. It's time to move ahead in life again, find that spark again, and let it energize you from now on. You deserve nothing less. Charge." You see how that talks about the promise? You see how it presents that opportunity and directly speaks to people's desire to better their lives? That's one of the reasons that people buy nonfiction books, and it's one of the reasons why that book has sold over 100,000 copies. What other kinds of books sell for this reason? Well, as a category, the biggest group of books in this space by copies sold is probably cookbooks. You buy another one of the books we sold, Baking with the Cake Boss, because you believe you can make incredible cookies, cakes, and pastries. You buy a book like Body for Life because you believe you can get fit. Most books on investing fall into this category too. Peter Lynch's One Up on Wall Street, which is one of the most successful personal finance books of all time, is smack dab in this space. If you didn't get it from the title, the subtitle makes it perfectly clear. How to use what you already know to make money in the market. By now, you're probably starting to see the point. Does your book fit into one of these two categories? Is it a fix for a problem, or does it present an opportunity? If so, I want you to start thinking about exactly how to articulate that fact. We're going to do a little bit of writing when we get to the end of this section. If your book is a fix or an opportunity, start thinking about exactly what it promises the reader. But for now, let's talk about the third reason that people buy nonfiction books. The third reason people buy nonfiction books is to learn more about a subject they're already fascinated with. To learn more about a subject they're already fascinated with. Learn more about a subject they are already fascinated with. If they're not already fascinated by the subject, but you want them to be, it's probably not a book, it's a magazine article. If you're writing about the people who dismantle ships in Bangladesh, or if you're writing about telephony in rural Alaska, it might actually be fascinating. And there were magazine articles on those two subjects in the Atlantic Monthly and the New Yorker, respectively, that made a big mark on that world, but they're just not good subjects for books. Let's look at my obstetrician memoir that didn't work. There's no question that people find babies fascinating. Obstetricians, on the other hand, maybe not so much. Andy Roddick beat me with a frying pan, however. People are fascinated by sports. Absolutely, positively fascinated by them. They obsess over statistics. They join fantasy leagues. They buy the clothing from their favorite teams. It's the same thing with books that are based on TV shows or celebrity subjects. So Keith Richards' autobiography, for example, sold over 500,000 copies in hardcover in the United States. Why? People didn't read it to learn how to be a rock star. They didn't read it to get step-by-step instructions on how to snort your father's ashes with a little bit of cocaine, which Richards evidently did, according to the book. They read it because they were absolutely, positively fascinated by him and by the Rolling Stones. And how can you blame them? I mean, Johnny Depp admitted to basing the character of Captain Jack Sparrow in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies on Keith Richards. And you don't do that if someone's not absolutely fascinating. So, what was the best overall best-selling nonfiction book of 2010, according to USA Today, and the fourth best-selling book overall, edged out only narrowly by The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo series? That's right, Decision Points by George Bush. Talk about fascination. If you're a fan of that particular president, when you think about the inflection points of his presidency, you're probably fascinated to know what he was thinking when he made a lot of his decisions. And if you're not a fan, you're probably dying to know what the heck that guy was thinking when he made a lot of his decisions. Either way, he still sold close to 3 million hardcovers and who knows how many ebooks. And again, regardless of what you think about him, he still sold at least 500,000 more books in the U.S. than Bill Clinton, who's enormously fascinating in his own right. Okay, so how is this relevant to you? I mean, after all, only two or three of you taking this course are ever going to be president of the United States, and only a couple dozen are going to be rock stars or movie stars or celebrities. That doesn't particularly matter. The author of the book doesn't have to be fascinating, just the subject. Levitt and Dubner, honestly, are two pretty boring guys. They're a journalist and a college professor, and Freakonomics still sold well over 1 million copies in hardcover. Why? Well, at its heart, it's a book about human behavior and the parts of human behavior that are counterintuitive. Counterintuitive books tend to fascinate. If you can rock someone's world and tell them that something they've always thought was true is false, or vice versa, you're going to sell some books. So let's look at the bestseller list to see what else falls into this category. Heaven is for Real. Over 2.5 million copies sold, and 3 years after its release, it was still selling more than 5,000 copies a week. No doubt people are fascinated by the afterlife. Same thing with one of the most successful books of 2012 and 2013, Proof of Heaven, a neuroscientist's near-death experience and journey into the afterlife. Heaven by itself is pretty fascinating, but a take on the subject from someone whose profession you would generally think wouldn't deal with that particular subject, or would take the opposite view from most people, makes for a blockbuster. The Guinness Book of World Records, one of the best-selling books of all time. Why? Fascination. What else? Books on popular science like Longitude or Chaos or Gödel, Escher, Bach. All of Malcolm Gladwell's books fall under this category. You get the picture. So that's number three. People buy books on subjects they're already fascinated by. Number four, people definitely read books to live vicariously through the lives of others, good, bad, and ugly. They read books about celebrities and executives not just because they're fascinated by them, but to imagine for a moment what it might be like to be one. And they read books by people who have had extreme experiences so they can feel terrified by proxy without actually being in danger. Books by people like James Fry or Dave Peltzer or Frank McCourt. They buy books by the guy who was caught under a boulder and had to saw off his own arm to survive, or by the young woman who was nearly killed by a shark and lost her arm while she was surfing. If reading a book is like riding a roller coaster, there's a market for it. And they buy books like those to be lifted up and inspired, or to commiserate or emulate people they want to be like. Elizabeth Gilbert's Eat, Pray, Love falls into this category. So does Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And then you've got books like Chris Kyle's American Sniper, or Marcus Luttrell's Lone Survivor, or even Anne Frank's The Diary of a Young Girl. Books like all of these can open up an entire other world and allow people to get outside themselves and experience things they never thought possible. And there are countless others that might not have sold more than a million copies, like some of the ones I just mentioned, but that have changed a lot of lives just the same. So that's number four. People will buy books to live vicariously through the lives of others, to find inspiration, and to prove that all things are possible. To live vicariously through the lives of others. The fifth reason people will buy nonfiction books is for the same reason they buy novels: to follow characters they care about through a compelling story. This is a category called narrative nonfiction. It's nonfiction that tells a story. Most people listening to this program probably aren't writing in this category, but I wanted to include it because whenever I don't, someone always says, "But what about?" And they talk about Seabiscuit or Devil in the White City, and I generally have to explain that there's this category in the next two as well. Some of the most popular books of all time as well fall into this area. Everything from true crime stories like Truman Capote's In Cold Blood to books like Stephen Ambrose's Nothing Like It in the World about the building of the Transcontinental Railroad and books in that sphere. The sixth category is humor. People will buy books to laugh too. Shit My Dad Says, The Bro Code, joke and novelty books, although the internet's killing those off. And then the seventh category is to be visually stimulated. Art books fall into this category. Coffee table books. That sort of thing. But this category is rapidly going away as the internet and electronic devices become capable of higher resolutions. And honestly, to print books like these, it's very, very expensive. And delivering them electronically is usually a lot easier for publishers, a lot better for authors, and a much better experience for readers. So there you've got it. The seven reasons people buy books. Number one, to solve a problem they know they have. Number two, to take advantage of an opportunity they believe exists. Number three, to learn more about a subject they're already fascinated by. Number four, to live vicariously through the lives of others, good, bad, and ugly. Number five, to follow characters they care about through a compelling story. Number six, to laugh. And number seven, to get visual stimulation. I want to drive this point home one more time, since it's so important, so I'm going to go straight to the top. Let's take a quick look at the top-selling nonfiction books of all time and figure out which category each falls into. Men Are from Mars, Women Are from Venus by John Gray. I've been fortunate enough to share a stage with John, and whatever you think about his specific theory about gender relations, when it comes to talking about relationships, the guy is better than just about anyone else. The book that started it all has sold millions of copies. And as you'll notice about this book and the next couple of books I'm going to talk about, the most successful books of all time often fall into multiple categories. Yep, you got it. There are multiple reasons that people buy them. And because there are multiple reasons that people buy them, there are multiple audiences and multiple income streams, and they get bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, a book doesn't necessarily have to fall into multiple categories to be a blockbuster, but it often helps. So, Men Are from Mars, Women Are from Venus absolutely, positively helps readers solve a problem they may know they have, right? For some people, they're in a relationship that's not working. they're having marriage issues, or they're fighting all the time, or they feel like their partner doesn't understand them. And this book promises that by reading it and taking its advice, their current relationship will get better. Interestingly, they've changed the subtitle on John Gray's book, but the hardcover edition subtitle is A Practical Guide for Improving Communication and Getting What You Want in Your Relationships. So it's not just people who are unhappy with their relationships. It's people who are unhappy because they're not even in a relationship in the first place. Or maybe someone isn't even necessarily unhappy with their relationship, but they think that it could be better, and that's reason number two. Improving communication, taking advantage of an opportunity they believe exists. It also hits people who are fascinated by men or women or the differences between them and how they communicate. So this is a solid three-category book. Next title, You Can Heal Your Life by Louise Hay. Over 30 million copies sold. It's about healing physical ailments through positive thinking. Do the people who buy this book have a problem? Yep. Do they know they have a problem? Yep. Does this book promise to give them the tools to solve it? Yep. Do people think that opportunity exists? You better believe it. Here are some of the other best-selling books of all time. You figure out which categories they fall into. Let's just go down the list of Wikipedia's best-selling nonfiction books of all time. Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. The Height Report by Sheer Height. The Purpose-Driven Life by Rick Warren. Who Moved My Cheese by Spencer Johnson. The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen R. Covey. The Happy Hooker by Xavier Hollander. The South Beach Diet by Arthur Agatston. All of those have sold more than 20 million copies, so I think you get the picture. So let's see how well you did at the test at the beginning of the program. We're going to talk about the 10 books that worked, my 10 books, and then just quickly assign them categories as to why they worked. Number 1, Killzone, the book's about cops shooting people. Easily a subject people are fascinated by, and the way that it was told, the officers themselves were compelling characters who had incredible stories to tell. So a two-category book, for sure. Going Corporate, The Corporate Survival Guide. Definitely people had a problem. If you were looking for a job and you didn't know how to get one, this would help you, or it would help you deal with problems you had with your colleagues, or it would help you take advantage of an opportunity you believed exists to climb the corporate ladder. Also fits into the humor category. 3, The Economics Primer, Common Sense Economics, subject many people are fascinated by and want to learn more about. 4, The Story of the Avalanche Rescue, both a great narrative book, one with well-drawn characters and a compelling story, and dog rescues and skiing are subjects that many, many people are fascinated by. Fallen, The Story of the Diamond, Flawless, The Story of the Diamond Heist. That one is all about an amazing story, and if there's any subject that people are fascinated by, it's diamonds. The Dominatrix Memoir, I'm not even going to tell you that one, but we know that people are fascinated by that subject. Crash of the Titans, The Account of the Financial Collapse, multiple category book, Man 2.0, we've already talked about, multiple category book, and The Charge, multiple category book. So, at this point, if my experience holds from the folks that I've spoken to at conferences and in the world in general, about 40 to 50% of you should probably be seriously rethinking the subject of your book. And now remember, if your idea doesn't fall into one of these categories, don't abandon it. It might still be a fabulous topic for a seminar or a coaching program or some other format, but it shouldn't be your book. And now at this point, I want you to seriously think about how your book fits into the framework. So write down which categories it falls into and do some brainstorming. Is there any way you can address the topic that adds another category? That is to say, can you give your audience another reason to buy your book? Or can you give another audience a reason to buy your book? Go for it. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about how these categories apply to marketing your book, but that's why this part comes before that one. Because you can market the wrong book all you want to, but people won't buy it. Well, I mean, I guess if you market it as fitting into one of these categories, people will buy it, but then they'll be really disappointed and miserable when you don't deliver, and they'll hate you for fooling them, so don't do that. Cool. All right. It's time to wrap up Module 2, and at this point, you have absolutely positively no reason for writing anything other than the right book right now. In Module 3, we're going to talk about everything you need to get into place before you actually start writing your book proposal, how to win before you begin. Because remember, you don't actually have to write a nonfiction book to start making money from a nonfiction book to start getting paid. You just have to have a plan. Before we get to Module 3, though, let's take a step back. I know what we've talked about over the past 2 hours or so has been a lot to take in, so I've built a pause into the training program at this point. It's important to understand that the clearer and better defined the vision for your book, the more success you will achieve. Module 3 in the program will be available in exactly 1 week. Take that week to listen to Modules 1 and 2 again, to think about the things you've learned, discuss that knowledge with a friend or a close advisor, and to complete the exercises on the worksheet if you haven't done that already. And I'll see you right back here in 7 days.